The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters. KSQD thanks attorney Ned Hearn for supporting this program. Ned Hearn specializes in intellectual property and business law with a focus on entertainment, internet, and computer software business and their convergence, intersecting content, media, and technology in the digital environment. More info at www.internetmedialaw.com. Thank you, Ned Hearn, for supporting KSQD 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Be Bold America is a live, bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to reunite this country and reclaim our democracy. Be Bold America is for those who want to understand the unique challenges ahead and who are curious to learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to reclaim our democratic republic. Our future depends on it. Our program today is Civilization's Plight. Are we engineered for a world that no longer exists? For all of human evolution, we've been rewarded by nature for maximizing our growth. That reward, the very brain chemistry that has programmed our motivations, is now propelling us towards calamity, climate change, political fascism, pandemics, exponential increases in denialism, fake news and lies of all kinds. Are these symptoms of an evolutionary mistake? As we hit the finite limits of the only living planet in the known universe, and the only one which we can ever hope will sustain humanity, what are the unacknowledged constrictions which bind our choices and frustrate our attempts at happiness? As we continue to use old habits born of evolutionary biology in dealing with a fundamentally new world. In this show, we'll explore what the limits to our choices imposed by physical reality, by biological reality, and how these impact the individual and the emergent civilization we've made. We'll then explore how the future might evolve and also how it most likely will evolve. We have big things to do. Before tackling these subjects, I just wanted to say that both Dr. Richard Nothinis and I are calling into the studio from home. However, our program engineer, Emily Dunham, is in the studio and will be on the boards coordinating the program. So if either of our phones drops the call, Rick and I will just call back into the studio. Using distancing technology, as we are today, may be one way. We're already dealing with a fundamentally new world. Now on with the show. Dr. Richard Nothinis, Rick to his friends, is an astronomy department chair at Cabrillo College here in Santa Cruz. He earned his bachelor's degree in mathematics at the University of Arizona, followed with a master's degree in aerospace engineering, specializing in fluid dynamics. He then worked as thermal systems analyst and designer in the space program in San Diego's General Dynamics. He returned to academia at Stanford University in applied physics and finished his PhD at UCLA in astronomy and astrophysics. In the past 10 years, Rick has changed his focus to climate science, to civilization as thermodynamic system, and how evolution has taken us to where we are today. Welcome to the show, Rick, and thank you for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you, Jill. It's good to be with you again.
Well, it's lovely to have you. We're going to have quite a heavy topic to talk about today, but I think a really important one. Just to dive in right away, my first question is that in the show title, it says that our world no longer exists. If it's gone, then what world are we living in now?
Well, so there's two answers to that. So one would be we're living in the
Anthropocene. So this is a new geologic epoch where we are the top determiner of the system that we live in. But really, there's a more insidious answer, and that is that we're living in a world that our basic genetic inheritance has not adapted us to deal with. That's our plight. That's our trouble, is that we don't live in that world anymore. We've come to the limits of the Petri dish, and we don't have the emotional tools, even though we have the intellectual tools, we don't have the emotional tools to really deal with that.
So this, you know, the evolution, as you suggest, the evolution of emotional has, perhaps contrary to many people's thinking, has taken us to a bad place. Can you explain that? You think that our emotional evolution has taken us to a bad place?
Yeah. Well, so nature gave us this capacity called emotions, and they're kind of an instantaneous summing up of everything in our values to basically two places, either for us or against us. And those emotions have their variations, of course. So there's many ways that we can be attracted or happy about something, many ways we can be unhappy. But they all tend to fall into a binary place. And those are what we experience as our result. Now, how do we deal with things which we want? How is it that nature signals us of what we want? And those systems are hormonal systems, basically. So we have the dopamine and we have the serotonin receptors, and those give us the reward mechanisms inside the brain. So the brain actually experiences these things, and then that becomes the motivation to further go along that path. That's what we mean by the emotional change. Now, the problem is that how does evolution work? So the way evolution works by natural selection is it motivates us to grow. It motivates us to command resources and energy, primarily, for the purposes of promoting the species. It isn't so much that we like promoting the species, it's that when we have that desire, we tend to give off more offspring. We tend to have more offspring, and those offspring, to some extent, inherit those characteristics that we have. And so they, too, want to promote. And by this means, species become more adapted to the world in which they live. Now, as long as the tools that the species has are, let's say, limited enough, then there's other species that will tend to compete also, and you tend, in an ecological sense, to find some sort of equilibrium, or perhaps a bit of a seesawing equilibrium with your surroundings. Here's the fatal problem that nature did. She invented an entirely new capacity that no other species seems to have, and that is the forebrain. That is the ability to conceptualize, to reason, to generate, to see and to generate patterns, and to generalize from those patterns to principles, then test those principles and see if they work. And it's been a fantastically successful strategy. Too successful, because we've now taken ourselves from being just one among millions of species to being the top dog by far. And if it were some other species that didn't have quite the same capacities as we do, then, you know, like let's say the dinosaurs who ruled their world for a long time, they didn't have the means to cope with an asteroid coming in, and they perished. We have the means to basically do anything. I mean, even asteroids are not really a danger to us now. We've discovered almost all of them that are on orbits that might someday cause trouble. Only the little ones might get through and cause a little bit here and there. We don't have that. Well, we're top predator, and we don't really have a lot of competition. Unfortunately, we're still driven by this impulse to growth, and yet we live on a finite planet, and there's no other planet that can support us. That's the problem. We don't have the emotional tools to deal with that. We have the intellectual tools, but it requires us to act against our emotions, to act against our drives. And there are people who are trained to do that. We call them scientists. And there's the vast majority who do not. And unfortunately, we're ruled by the majority in our world. And they're the ones who have controlled things and brought us to where we are today, which is on the brink of a very dire future.
So you refer to nature giving us a reward system that motivates our behavior. And that's what's led us astray? Is that what you're talking about, is nature in this reward cycle has led us astray?
Well, growth is great until finally you have reached the end, and then all of a sudden it's not only not great, it's catastrophic. Again, so we go back to the Petri dish. So all those little bacteria are celebrating and growing like crazy, and, you know, it's just, it's wonderful. And there might be a few bacteria in there who warn, wait a minute, I think I see way off in the edge, there's a glass edge to this. And if we get there, then we're in big, big trouble. But the rest say, ah, everything's fine right now, and who are we to complain? You know, we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out when we get there. Not even really believing there is an edge, frankly. But when we get there, then it's too late, okay? The planning that needed to be done was long before you got there, and that was throttling back your growth, re-engineering, perhaps, the way that we respond to our nature. And we haven't done that, and that's brought us to where we are today. And I think this pandemic we're going through right now is a kind of a perfect analogy. We elected leaders who chose to just put their head in the sand and choose their immediate gratifications over what could have been a planning that would have saved us from at least the worst consequences of what it looks like we might be facing. I mean, right now I see the numbers going up even faster than in Italy, which was, of course, devastated by this. And yet this person, you know, was freely elected by the people who are driven by these impulses, and it's short-term gratification that was once rewarded by, you know, keeping us out there perhaps even all day and all night, you know, grabbing the most fruit and grabbing the most this and that and having a bigger clan than the neighboring tribe. And, you know, that's all great as long as there's a limitless earth. But we've come to the limits of our earth, and we've been warned about that now for 50 years by scientists, and we pay no heed.
We don't have systems in place that would do that. Energy consumption. Oh, I'm sorry, Rick, go ahead.
No, I finished. Go ahead.
Okay. It sounds like energy and energy consumption figures into this. I know you've become very interested in the thermodynamics of civilization as a whole, and wondering if that relates perhaps to the personal energy. Doesn't biology have something to say about how living organisms are constrained by energy?
Yeah, so nature, so everything that is living is a movement towards taking what is disordered and turning it into an ordered system that will actually support the growth and the well-being of your species. So randomness, the decay of things into randomness, is, of course, not life. Life, if anything, is complex and ordered. Even more so, of course, in our civilization. And all complexity requires energy to power it, and not only energy to create it, but energy to keep it from decaying by the second law of thermodynamics through entropy. So nature, of course, understands this, realizes it. I'm anthropomorphizing a bit nature, calling her a conscious being, but of course she's just obeying the laws of what works. But she understands this, and so what has happened is she's made it a goal for us to be parsimonious with our energy consumption. We go through an instantaneous feeling of either go for it or not worth the trouble, kind of a feeling when we have a decision to make. And not worth the trouble really means not worth the energy. So, and this whole idea was first brought to me by a great speaker and a great systems thinker, Nate Higgins, energy specialist and now a professor at University of Minnesota. And listening to his talks, I really got it. He's actually a good speaker. I'd recommend him to anyone. And I began thinking about it more deeply and wondering, so how does that really work? So how is it that nature constrains us through energetics? And what she'll do is we'll go through, perhaps by experience learning, you know, it's not worth it to climb that tree to get that last little tiny undeveloped fruit at the top, because the risk of falling and, you know, breaking a leg is higher than the value that I'll get from the calories generated from that fruit. So we look for the low-hanging fruit. We look for the easy stuff. Those decisions are constantly made because we're trying to conserve the energy we have. It's what's interesting is that our brain, which does all this processing, is by far the most energy-consumptive organ that we have. It actually consumes 10 times more energy per pound than the rest of our body. And we have to power that with calories. And it's easy for us in our modern world to forget that for most of our evolution, getting those calories was difficult. We had to chase it down and kill it, you know, or be killed. We had to outcompete the insects and other tribes and so forth for even the vegetables and fruits that, you know, might not kill us. Of course, then even then, we had to pay attention to which ones we harvested. Maybe you didn't get the knowledge. Oh, you didn't hear the word? Yeah, those things will kill you. Don't eat that. This is another way that nature, you know, kind of prunes the tree.
So, well, I need to chase down a station identification. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org or catch up on programs by visiting the KSQD websites or archives. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Today our topic is civilization's plight. Are we engineered for world that no longer exists? I'm going to turn it over to Emily for a promo.
Thanks, Jill. Residents of California are under shelter-in-place orders, requiring residents to stay at home except for essential services. The orders intend to help restrict the spread of COVID-19 in the community and preserve healthcare capacity to handle cases as they occur. The measures are based on best medical practices to slow the spread of the aggressive virus. They are not intended to alarm, and doctors encourage everyone to keep their spirits up while adjusting routines to protect themselves and the community. Avoid gatherings of any size and maintain at least 6 feet of space from others when you are out for essential services or exercise. Wash hands frequently and avoid touching your face. While complying with the order, you are also encouraged to support others by checking on vulnerable neighbors and making sure their needs are met, helping families whose children are out of school, and supporting local businesses where possible, including ordering takeout food. As a community, we will get through the emergency together. For general information on COVID-19, please call 211 or text coronavirus to 211-211 or visit www.santacruzhealth.org/coronavirus. Thanks, and back to you, Jill.
Thank you, Emily. And we're speaking with Dr. Richard Nolfinius, Astronomy Department Chair at Cabrillo College. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And I'm sorry I needed to interrupt you there, Rick. What are the limits to our choices by physical reality? What you were talking about that. What are our limits?
Well, actually, you know, before we get there, I think I'd like to explain something else, and that is backtrack a little bit. So how did nature engineer us? And this is something I've not really seen explained in quite this way, and I think it's actually a nice way to explain this, and that is that nature gave us reward systems, but she realized that it was most effective in achieving our dominance or our growth as a species and our successful occupation of our ecological niche if she had those rewards spaced out in three different systems over time. So we have the extreme short-range reward, and that one's mediated by the dopamine system. So dopamine receptors in the brain give you an immediate rush, an immediate gratifying feeling if you indulge. And then there's the intermediate range, and that's almost a more spiritual realm. And this is where you get a satisfaction with a sort of a larger integration with your values. You feel almost a spiritual might be too big a word in some sense, but it's a deeper, a more profound, and a more ultimately gratifying feeling.
Harmonious?
Harmonious, right. Harmonious with your deeper values. Then there's finally the long range. The long range only comes into view, and the reward for that only comes into view after pretty much a considerable length of time. And so you need these short-term motivations in order to feel the desire to continue and ultimately get to a place where the long range comes in. Now, the long range comes in from a feeling of the light bulb, of genuine understanding of how this relates to your long-term goals. So long-term, the system that does that is reason. So what you do is we are constantly looking at the evidence of nature, and that evidence comes in, and our brain is this pattern-making machine. It wants to understand. We have to actually actively use energy to prevent that integration. This is the curse of people who are unfortunately condemned to that by their own repressions and their own desires not to understand things, because our brain wants to. And it will be like a puppy almost and run off and draw conclusions. And of course, we have to keep our puppy on a leash and realize that not every conclusion we draw to can be trusted. So we want to avoid jumping to premature conclusions, which are wrong. Unfortunately, there are too many people who jump off to those conclusions, find them satisfying some short-term motivation, some short-term reward, maybe tribalism or not being proven wrong if they have a fragile ego, and then they latch onto it. They stick to it like a tick, and they refuse to let go. These are the people I find it hardest to try and talk to. They're really not open to reason, and why I so much enjoy talking, on the other hand, to scientists who they understand how exciting it can be to actually be shown. Oh, really? That's evidence I didn't know about. Really? So can you quote me a source on that? And they come back, you know, that's exciting. I was wrong. I didn't realize that there was this whole other realm out there. Wow, that opens up a whole ton of new possibilities. And then they get all excited and they go back to work. That's the way scientists operate. Unfortunately, most people don't. In a one-man, one-vote system, that's, again, another one of the tragedies that we've created out of our own political systems. So anyway, there's these three mechanisms, and the longest and the hardest and the one that, unfortunately, the fewest people use is the one that we really need today, because we have to look past the tomorrow and next week and next year and see, you know, from my standpoint, of course, the dire thing I see off in the horizon is climate change. It is a relentless steamroller, and it may be moving very slowly, but it is a steamroller. And if we continue to ignore it, the costs only go up.
Well, it seems like what you're talking about is also what could come into play are people's egos and ideology. You know, that's what holds on to that viewpoint where you're talking about a scientist's ego. Really is in the is in the pursuit of knowledge, really not as what's been discovered. Is that right?
Well, it's great that in the reward system of science, at least primarily, and in the perhaps the wonderful field of astronomy, where we don't make huge bucks by discovering dark matter or whatever, okay? So nobody's going to pay us $1 billion for discovering the nature of the dark matter particle. We just get the incredible satisfaction of understanding something so deep about nature. The reward systems are built into science so that we're rewarded for actually being right. You know, we write papers, we take them on a little tour around other universities, we give colloquia and seminars, and if others have objections that, you know, don't fit with their knowledge, their evidence, not their prejudices, but their knowledge, then we discover those. Maybe we didn't know those. And we have to go back and rework this, have to rework that. Finally, it becomes to a point where we write a paper and we submit the paper, and then the editor of the journal sends it out to other referees to read it over and see if there's anything else wrong with it. And if it passes all those, then it gets published. It doesn't necessarily mean it's final truth, because it might still be limited by the technology of the day, but it's at least in the game, and it's at least solidly worth a close look by people. It's not just some crazy blogger, you know. So science is built that way. Unfortunately, you know, most of the business world is not. We're rewarded instead by money, and capitalists would like to have you believe that the way it works is, well, we, you know, we aren't going to try to tell people what they should want. We just give them what they do want and what they're especially willing to pay for. And we're not going to be moral judges and finger wag them and tell them, no, you shouldn't want this, you should want that. So, hey, if they want it, you know, then we'll supply it. As long as they're willing to pay for it, we'll supply it. And that may sound all very egalitarian in a certain sense, but what they don't tell you is, well, you guys, if you don't want what we have, then we're going to manipulate you through hiring neuroscientists to be on our advertising team and figure out how to addict you, you know, whether it be through smoking or sugar or whatever, and, you know, or engaging your desire for, you know, competing for the top mates by envy or, you know, by a better haircut or God knows what. You know, we will manipulate you to the thing that we can produce for the highest profit per dollar invested. That's not good. That's not actually generating positive human values. And this is one of the things that we have to figure out how to change is how do we come up with a system which actually rewards us for doing genuine human good as revealed by the actual nature of human beings and not our short-term addictions, not our short-term gratifications. You know, unfortunately, capitalism just rewards for indulging and pandering to people's short-term motivations, even if it kills the planet.
It seems like our technological ability has outpaced maybe our biological side of us. What do you think about that?
Yeah.
Explain more about technology versus our human behavior.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, Jill, because it's true. So we have outpaced in our technological ability our actual maturity as a species. So why would that be? And I think the reason is because improving our technology, improving our scientific knowledge doesn't typically engage our deepest, it doesn't challenge us in acknowledging when we've made mistakes, you know. So if you learn that, you know, E equals MC squared instead of E equals MC cubed, it doesn't challenge your tribal alliances. It doesn't challenge your, you know, being hooked on ice cream. It doesn't challenge your, you know, dogmatic belief that you can never be proven wrong. It's like, oh, really? Well, how does that work? Okay, so you relook at it. And so we've made incredible, incredible advances. And it shows you what a brain can really do when it's not hindered by these mechanisms that, unfortunately, we still have built into our brain. You know, there's these interesting studies that show that Republicans have this inflated amygdala, which is the part of the brain that processes and experiences fear. Well, the liberals tend to have a much smaller, more normal-sized amygdala, and they have a larger, compared to the Republicans, a larger anterior cingulate cortex, and that's the part of the brain that processes error checking. It processes, really, critical thinking. I thought that was really interesting. And wondered, now why would that be? Is that just because Republicans are born with this unfortunate, you know, brain malady? They just, you know, inherited a bad set of genes and they got an inflated this and a withered that? No, the science of neuroplasticity shows that our brains, right up till the day we die, even in our 90s, is constantly remolding itself. So the evidence suggests that what's really happening is the fear mechanism is just getting reinforced over and over, and that Republicans find they get that they're like the rat, you know, with the hand, the little paw on the bar, tapping it over and over to get that dopamine fix. You know, they almost like having their fear mechanism stoked. You know, so Fox News tells them, you know, God knows what latest conspiracy theory and, you know, the deep state and whatever, and it inflates, and it also solidifies their tribal alliances to their fellow Republicans, and it it withers the part of the brain they're not using, which is actual critical thinking, and saying, well, now, wait a minute, let's step back. Does this conflict with any other evidence that I know? Where might this be wrong? Et cetera. They don't do that. And they get rather, you know, angry, as you know, if you try and point that out to them.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Our topic is civilization's plight. Are we engineered for a world that no longer exists? And it's over to you, Emily.
Hi, I'm Tom Hartman, your host for Progressive Talk on KSQD 90.7 FM, community radio for the Central Coast, 4 p.m. weekdays. KSQD is a vital media resource for listeners in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties and worldwide on the web. Please help support this station by making a contribution to keep the station thriving. Go to ksqd.org and give what you can to help keep shows like mine coming to you daily at 90.7 FM. You know, with six large corporations owning most of the media, it's essential that listeners support grassroots, locally run radio stations like KSQD. Community radio is responsive to its listeners and isn't afraid to challenge the status quo. Please join me, Tom Hartman, in supporting KSQD 90.7 FM, community radio for the Central Coast, by making your pledge today online at ksqd.org. That's 90.7 FM, KSQD. Catch me right here at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you, and tag your it.
We're speaking with Dr. Richard Nolfinius, Astronomy Department Chair at Cabrillo College, and I'm your host, Jill Cody. Now, Rick, you were talking about fear, and that is a button for me, because politics for years, decades, maybe always since the beginning of time, has used fear to manipulate people. And it's so frustrating for me that a lot of people don't realize they're being manipulated that way. I have worked for years on a concept called the energies dimension, where the creative and constructive energies are security and trust and love and approval and acceptance and recognition and faith. And then there's destructive and disruptive energies that are insecurity and fear and anxiety and anger and hatred and rejection. And it just seems that most people would want to live on the creative and constructive side of life and would be repelled by the destructive types of things that always being injected with the fear and the anxiety and disapproval and hatred.
Well,
you were starting to talk about that. So, you know, can you expand a little bit more?
Yeah. So you and I talked a while back, I think it was your first show, on the subject of anger.
And why are we so angry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why are we so angry? My thoughts are a little different. Obviously, we would like to live our lives mostly experiencing good emotions. So there's no mystery there. But yet we do live in a world that we don't control. Maybe to some extent we can, but certainly not to a large extent. And so we're going to be confronted with things that bring up not just positive emotions, but negative emotions. And this is a problem I actually have with progressives who actually will demonize the very emotion, the very experience of the emotion of anger or fear or really any of these emotions, which they think of as somehow proof of your not quite evolved human capacities. You know, you're just not quite a full human if you're still feeling such things. And I disagree with that totally. I think nature gave us these emotions as a clear and immediate signal on whether what we're confronted with in the moment with our perceptions is for us or against us. So anger has a use. You should be angry when your values are threatened. That anger is energizing you to defend those values. If you don't feel that anger, you tend to just let yourself be walked right over. You know, no matter how wonderful you are, if you're not willing to fight for your values, then you're just going to be taken over. You know, we've seen that tragically in Nazi Germany. We've seen it all through history. I think there's a valid thing to be said for anger. Now, if you walk around with chronic anger, typically those are people who who are at war with their own experience of anger. But the proper way in which emotions happen is you experience them, you experience them completely, and then they flow right through you. They don't control you after that. You may feel the knowledge of what brought it on, but you're not captured and held by it in some negative, horrific way. If you're in an environment which your anger is constantly being, anger button's being pushed all the time, and I can certainly understand that today, well, at some point you have to say, you know, yeah, there are external forces that are going to push that, and then you just got to find your own retreat. And realize that this is, don't make matters worse by condemning yourself for experiencing anger. You know, it's a natural thing when you're confronted with value challenges like that.
I do remember us having this discussion before because I talk about constructive anger and using your anger constructively in addressing whatever the issue is, just not seething in it. But and of course, all those emotions are the disruptive emotions are natural, but you're right. It's moving through them. You just don't want to predominantly live in them. And that's what I'm concerned about with fear and the fear that is always constantly stoked, I think, in this country and why so many people seem to like to live there. And I guess that's your point about pushing that button for that dopamine, response.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. So when you experience a lot of fear, that can then generate anger as a way to try and fight whatever you're afraid of. And then that experience of anger can be experienced as a sense of power that you may be missing because maybe deep down, you know, you haven't really been very effective as a person in expressing your personal power. And so feeling angry can almost like be, yeah, you know, I'm a powerful person after all. Okay, I don't have to feel like such a wimp. I'm really a powerful person. I mean, I'm going off the deep end a little bit here, but you kind of get my point. I think this is why, you know, there are people out there who want to stoke your anger because they know that you're going to get a little tickle out of it in a certain way by following it on. And, you know, letting the fear trigger the anger, and then the anger triggers the feeling that, oh, well, you know, I'm somebody. I'm willing to go out there and fight. And yet, if the source of the fear is all bogus, then really what you should be feeling is, whoa, I sure walked into that one. You know, maybe I should smarten up as opposed to anger up.
Well, we do have a brain, which can reason, and we have scientists who can clearly see these things. So why aren't they carrying the day?
How are they treated?
It seems like, how are they treated? And there seems to be an entire group of people that are rejecting science that isn't in their circle of influence.
You know, science seems like such an unarguable, obvious good in all senses, not only in, let's say, the serotonin sense of satisfying your built-in curiosity and your built-in desire to have as complete a knowledge of your world as possible, but also just in a technological sense, you know, to get the things that you want, you know, get richer in some sense. It seems like such an obvious total good, and yet throughout my life, science has suffered only a continual downward spiral in terms of its regard by the average, let's say the average person in the U.S. Obviously, there's exceptions. Obviously, there's people who feel all kinds of different things about science, and many of them very good, but yet it would have amazed the me who grew up in the space age in the 1960s to look at how science is regarded today. You realize that only 36% of Republicans feel that colleges and universities are a positive good to society. 36%.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? I would have never thought that. Anybody who told me that years ago, I'd have just said, look, I may be one of the most cynical political people of all, but even I would not believe that. I know politics means two words, poly as in many, ticks as in blood-sucking insects, but still, 36%, that's it? And yet here we are. Here we are.
Well, I think an example of your downward spiral, or you tell me what you think, is that it seems to me this pandemic it's based on ideology and whether you believe it's serious or not. I would have thought, or at least I think in our experience of past pandemics, that people just put politics and ideology aside and realize there is an illness and something we all want to protect is our health and our family, and we start doing what we need to do to be safe. And here with this pandemic, it's there are those who think it's not that serious because of an ideology.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite
tell me,
it. I think
more.
It's a little simpler. Yeah, okay. I know. The Republicans have made their Faustian deal with Trump, okay? They've thrown in with the devil, and in for a penny, in for a pound, and they're hanging on as the car goes over the cliff. Like if you remember Rebel Without a Cause. That dates me, I guess, but... So they don't want to admit that, well, wait a minute, maybe it actually would be a smart thing to try and be a little more forceful. But then that challenges their notions of, well, maybe Trump's not the most brilliant person. And, oh, my God, it's like we've got a psychopath at the, at the wheel. And then that, sends them back to fear, I guess. I don't think it's ideological so much as that we've thrown in with Trump. And, of course, Trump's motivations, they're much simpler. They're not ideological at all. I don't think he has an ideology. I think all he has is he's a bit Neanderthal in his reactions, and that is what's for me is what's going to happen. And what's for me is my immediate gratifications, and that includes blocking out any notion that I might be incorrect on something. It's inflating my incredibly and justifiably fragile ego and getting reelected to prop up that ego. People who feel incredibly deeply insecure because of their inadequacy are the very ones who are the most bombastic, the most power hungry. Those are the Adolf Hitlers of the world. And unfortunately, there's people who just want to throw in with a strong man, thinking and hoping that, well, maybe he'll, I don't feel all that adequate either myself, but he seems like, he seems like a strong person, so I think I'm going to throw in with him and maybe he'll solve things. It's also short-term. It's also energy parsimonious. People don't want to exert the actual energy it takes to just sit back and think, take on all the facts, judge them against what you know. Here's another problem. That's why I teach my students in my Chapter Zero section at Cabrillo. If you have a brain that is full of just disjointed, unconnected factoids, if you were never taught the importance of actually getting the light bulb that goes with the non-contradictory identification of a new fact with prior carefully assembled knowledge in your brain, then you'll never get that light bulb. There's no way that a new fact presented to you will give any other sensation than what you already feel, which is total confusion. So you don't get that ability to actually assemble. The only way out of that, you have to take your brain, open up the hatch, dump everything out, and then start afresh. It's almost like, somebody gives you a puzzle, but what they did is they took like 10 different puzzles, and they mixed all the pieces together, and then they just took all the mixed up pieces and then put them back in 10 different boxes, and they gave you one of the boxes. Of course, you're never going to be able to assemble a puzzle out of that, right? You've got a whole bunch of pieces that don't fit together. What you have to do is at some point realize they don't fit together. But if you went back to all 10 and you did the massive resorting, you actually could assemble a brain that really does work. Nature really did give you the ability to develop a brain that actually works. That's the pleasure that people who have been careful in assembling their knowledge experience. And what too many people who have given up, maybe they gave up at the tragic age of 3 or 4 to make sense of this world, what they will never experience. And they continually want to pull the world down to their level. Unfortunately, I think that's our president.
But how exciting it is when you are open to new facts and new ideas. You have that aha moment. And I don't want to let... before our next break, which is coming up, I don't want to let it go by that you have all these huge public presentation online at your Cabrillo College astronomy website, correct? Astro 7, is it? The planetary climate?
So,
can't anybody go into that and get your presentation?
Right. Here's my feeling about that. So I'm as an academic, I'm paid by the taxpayers. I feel like the taxpayers deserve what I create, whether or not they're in my class or not. I don't want to limit everything that I've created to just a Canvas session where only my own students can get access to it. I think what I've created should be available to all. Now, yeah, I could try and write scientific papers on all this, but then that costs a lot of money and grant writing, and I don't have time for all that, so not anymore anyway, not with the way things have gone.
Well,
I make PowerPoints, and those are available to everyone. And they're
and I've seen them, and they're quite extensive. Yeah, they're quite extensive. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Emily, you have a promo?
Yes, thank you, Jill. This week on New Dimensions, a conversation with poet and novelist Mary Mackey. Here, Mackey discussed the creative process, tapping into the unconscious, and the mission of the writer. She sees one of the duties of the poet today is to witness the beauty of the world as it changes and preserve that beauty for future generations. Join us for this inspiring edition of New Dimensions, Sunday at 6 p.m. That's just 15 minutes from now, here at KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station. Back to you, Jill.
Thank you, Emily. The topic we're discussing today is civilization's plight. Are we engineered for a world that no longer exists? We're talking with Dr. Richard Multinez, Astronomy Department Chair at Cabrillo College. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And one of the things that was stated in the beginning of what we talk about is how our future will evolve. How will our future evolve, in your opinion, Rick?
Well, unfortunately, the people who could lead us out of this are the scientists, and the people who are most vilified, unfortunately, these days are the scientists. They are now seen as a threat to the status quo. They are pointing out the flaws in the existing political economic paradigm. I see this even with people on the edges of economics who come from a background of physics and mathematics, and if they are not all about maximizing somebody's financial wealth, they're seen as a threat. They're vilified. They're taken out. You see this, of course, in Trump, basically dismantling the EPA this past weekend. I mean, he's now used the coronavirus as an excuse to say the EPA no longer really exists. All EPA laws are hereby suspended. Companies can do whatever they want. They want to dump poisons into the river. Hey, be our guest. It's absolutely unbelievable.
I think it's Naomi Klein's shock doctrine that she wrote about, is don't let a disaster go to waste. You know, get something out of it for your political advantage, your ideology. So, Rick, you mentioned to me that solutions are not going to come from techno-wizardry, nor from politicians on the horizon today, nor from anyone mired in our current paradigms. And this is probably a good lead to start talking about what our listeners can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing. Then where will solutions come from?
Well, what do we need to stop doing? Everything. What do we keep? Not much. It's a tough question, and I want to let me finish the thought on science. So the scientists are the people who could take us out because they are the ones who actually have the longest term view. They're not being given the chance. They're a tiny minority. They're not a voting majority. And so if scientists are not helping somebody earn coin, now I realize, you see, what's
science was really all about. It wasn't about the glorification of knowledge. It was a glorification of more stuff, you know, more bling, more, you know, how do we produce this for less money so that we can sell it to more people and make a bigger profit? Science was really just a handmaiden to engineering, which is a handmaiden to capitalism. Okay, but how are we going to get out of this? Okay, keep, stop, start. So we are at 5:50.
Yeah, what can listeners keep doing to help advance?
Good science functioning. That's about all I've got on my keep list.
How would a listener support that?
Well, for one thing, they should vote for those who support good college and university education so that we can keep producing scientists. I firmly believe, like Bernie Sanders, that it is an incredibly high return on investment to pay for students' education. I think that we should have college education free for all, and if that means raising taxes, well, so be it. I think it's a bargain. I think it's a very cheap bargain. It's unconscionable that we subject our students to unbelievable costs, and then we don't even let them discharge it through bankruptcy. I mean, where do they go to debtor's prison if they can't pay? It's unbelievable.
It's cruel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stop. So what do we stop? Our entire political economic paradigm has to change. Money has become its own fetish. It, just like the Pavlovian response that it dates back to our biology. Now it's not money as a creation of genuine good. It's money per se. In our society, if you have money, that alone is enough to guarantee you prestige. And, oh, you must be somebody. You are great. You are to be envied. You are better than me because you have more money. Well, of course, that's ridiculous. You know, they may or may not be better than you. They might be worse. A study showed that, in fact, among CEOs, the rate of occurrence of genuine, clinically diagnosed psychopaths, fitting that definition, is 21 times higher than in the general population. So that's not 10 or 20 or 30% higher. That's 2,100% higher than the general population, which has a rate of occurrence of psychopaths of only 1%. That's who runs our businesses. That's what we have encouraged through this short-termism. Profit motives that are anchored around the dopamine addictions and lies in advertising have got to stop. How to stop that?
My son was little, there was a video called Buy Me That, and it talked to children about how the advertising industry manipulated them to buy things. And it was really a fascinating video on talking to children about how they were being manipulated by the advertising industry. But you're talking about stopping our entire political economic paradigm. How would a listener do that? It's by letting go of that idea that people who have money are better than they are, or they should hand their power over to them versus
I would certainly say learning and digesting and getting that light bulb of understanding with these ideas is a first step. So that's what they would do. I think they would take advantage of great thinkers out there. And I don't mean just me. I mean people like Nate Higgins and Tim Garrett and many others, Joseph Tainter, people understand the limits to growth and the limits to this planet and that we can't continue to grow without catastrophe happening. And it's looming up ahead shorter and shorter. I think the way the universe, the world will actually evolve is we're going to have to hit bottom. This is the way most people who have fundamental problems actually end up changing. They don't change until they finally hit bottom. It's the rare person who was gifted with great mentors and great examples of people who can think their way through problems early, who tend to not have to hit bottom, who kind of, I wouldn't say a random walk, but they, follow perhaps a bit of a crooked path, but not that crooked, towards a good life by using their brain. Most people, unfortunately, don't. They're going to hit bottom, but with climate change hitting bottom is far too late to do anything about it.
I know you have a start, which is the Occupy DC idea.
Right, I was going to come to that next, yes. So as far as what people would do, I think the only solutions to these kind of global problems and both the damage that capitalism's doing and climate change is doing, those are purely global problems, okay? Your individual actions changing your individual lifestyle isn't going to do anything to help you against the consequences of climate change. The only solutions are going to come from government. And that's coming from somebody who long ago used to be a libertarian, you know, I was as anti-government as you could believe. And yeah, government's full of a lot of scurrilous people, but the solution's going to be to change it, not to get rid of it altogether. So I've advocated this for years. I think the most effective way is to realize the 3.5% rule. So this is an interesting thing. Studies show that if you can just get 3.5% of the population to get totally on board with engage in revolutionary acts, that's enough for a very high likelihood of being successful. You don't need a voting majority. If you wait for voting majority, you'll probably wait in vain. That's unfortunately what I see too many pacifists doing, is just waiting and hoping, waiting and hoping. Well, I've waited 67 years and nothing's changed. It's only gotten us to Donald Trump, somebody I thought only the 1% of pathological, you know, people would vote for. And yet here he is. So no, we need just 3.5%. So how do we do that? Well, 3.5% of the population is still 10 million people. That's too many to occupy D.C. But 100,000, I think we could do that. That only requires 0.3%, actually less than that, of the population. If we could get, 100,000 people would be enough to shut down Washington, D.C. And you have to go, of course, with a list of demands. The demands have to be reasonable. And the demands have to be such that we ain't leaving until you agree to peace. This isn't just a weekend march where you have some signs and you have some camaraderie and you have some fun. And, yeah, I've done those and those are fun. No, no, this is an occupation. You go and you don't leave.
Have you talked to Extinction Rebellion about this? Because it sounds like a perfect activity for them.
No, I have a little bit. They don't seem that interested in what I have to offer.
I need to wrap up. I want to thank Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Dunham, and give her another big thank you to our bold guest, Dr. Richard Noltenius. Thank you both for your expertise, and it's very much appreciated. Next on Be Bold America. Thank you, Rick. Next on Be Bold America, on Easter Sunday, we will be replaying a best-of show about the national popular vote and swing left. There are many questions still swirling around about the idea of national popular vote and what listeners can do to flip the Senate, the White House, and roll back Republican gerrymandering. Don't miss hearing these topics on Sunday, April 12th at 5 p.m. If you missed any part of this program or just in previous programs, you may on KSQD's website archive section or on my website, jillcodyauthor.com. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, Many Voices Station. Listen online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for New Dimensions. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.